18062 Kesey Road in Veronia, Oregon. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Diversity in Cannabis Networking Rally, Saturday, June 11th at 4 p.m. at the Village Ballroom in Portland. The first Minority Cannabis Business Association Networking Rally invites all who are interested in learning about the cannabis industry or networking with business owners, activists, medical professionals, and regulators. Again, that is the Diversity in Cannabis Networking Rally, Saturday, June 11th at 4 p.m. at the Village Ballroom, 704 Northeast Deacon Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. This is Kathleen Stevenson for Between the Covers. My guest is Danielle Dutton, author of the new novel, Margaret the First. Margaret the First is the story of Margaret Cavendish, the Duchess of Newcastle, who was born in 1623 and became a poet, a philosopher, a fiction writer, a playwright, and essayist. Danielle Dutton is also the author of the novel Sprawl and the collection of prose pieces Attempts at a Life. She is the editor of Dorothy, a publishing project dedicated to the works of fiction, mostly by women. She teaches creative writing at Washington University in St. Louis. Danielle Dutton, welcome to KBOO Radio.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Now, this is a unique novel based on the life of a unique woman in the 17th century. How did you become interested in Margaret Cavendish?
Well, I first read about her in Virginia Woolf's A Room of One's Own. I think it's in chapter 4 where Woolf is going through various women writers from the past and trying to sort of establish, in a way, like the beginning, the roots of writing by women, like professional quality writing by women. And Margaret Cavendish is one of the women she talks about, but she doesn't really settle on sort of the first important professional writer until she gets to Aphra Behn, which was right after Margaret Cavendish. You can tell she's sort of interested in Cavendish, but she's ultimately somewhat disappointed by the actual work itself. So that was the first time I read about her, but it didn't make a huge impression in terms of Margaret Cavendish herself. What I remember is that there's this wonderful description in that essay of Margaret as a cucumber. She has her, like, she describes her as a giant cucumber, like spreading all over the garden and crushing the flowers. And I remembered that description because it was so just strange and interesting. I had that in my mind when I was doing my PhD and I took a class on the new science, the sort of dawn of the Enlightenment. And I knew the names of almost all the men we were studying in that class, like Francis Bacon and Robert Hooke and Thomas Brown, Isaac Newton, but I had never heard of Margaret Cavendish. And that was so strange to me. And she was one of the figures in the course. So my major figure during my PhD was Virginia Woolf. So I was reading Woolf's work and I was taking this class and I put it together that this was the cucumber, this is the same person. And I just became totally fascinated by her. The more I learned about her, the more interesting she became to me. She designed her own dresses. She was the first woman ever invited to the Royal Society of London and then the last for 200 years. So she was just this really eccentric, fascinating figure. But, you know, Woolf ultimately is disappointed by her. And I just suspected there was more to the story and I just wanted to know what it was. So I started reading more and more and more about her.
Did you think you were going to write what you ended up writing about her when you started doing this? Or
no. I mean, for me, when I start a book, I never really know what I'm going to write, even when I'm starting it on purpose. But in this case, it was somewhat, there was something weirdly accidental about the way the book came about. I became fascinated by this period of the new science, and in particular in London. And I had this idea to write a novel set in London in the year 1666. And I was doing all this research on the strange experiments they were doing and on garden design. I was really interested in the garden design, which was very elaborate and specific at the time. And I was reading all of this, and yet everything I wrote, the more and more I wrote, the more and more it was about Margaret Cavendish. And so eventually, but over the course of a couple of years, it took me to realize, oh, wait, I think I'm just writing a novel about Margaret Cavendish. But she sort of took over what I thought I was doing slowly but surely.
She is such, as you mentioned, eccentric character and distinctive character. Can you talk about her character a little before we might have you read some from the book and we'll get a little bit of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think she's delightful, but she's certainly a very complicated person and character. She was shy to a sort of awkward degree. She had a hard time making friends throughout her entire life, but she also was extremely ambitious and she longed for fame. She was quite loving with her family and her husband. I mean, she was just a really complicated, interesting figure. I did my best to sort of bring that person to life. I mean, in some ways, there's a lot written about parts of her life, but then there are other parts of her life that I had to imagine. So, for example, I had to sort of imagine what she would be like as a girl. That was one of the most fun parts of writing the book, actually, was just imagining an imaginative, precocious, bookish little girl growing up in the 17th century.
You mentioned that she's shy for validation. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like a tension throughout the book that her character is in this predicament.
Yeah. Yeah, she's so shy, painfully shy, and yet she's desperate for people to pay attention to her. And I think some people find that really confusing. I mean, some readers have said to me, what do you think that is? I mean, people have tried to diagnose her, you know, to me. Do you think she was bipolar? but no, I think people are complicated. I mean, I myself, and I would imagine there are plenty of writers and other sort of artistic people out there. I feel most comfortable alone, you know, and being quiet. But that doesn't mean that I don't want people to read the book, for example. I think it's not that uncommon, actually, to be shy and retiring and yet long for attention and not know how to go about getting it. And so she would want it, and then she would act out in these sort of incredible ways to get attention, such as attending the theater topless, in a topless gown. Yeah. So, I mean, she went about it in these peculiar ways. But I didn't want to villainize her, and I didn't want to romanticize her. I just wanted to try to figure her out and make her a human in my novel, you know, the best that I could. At the end of the day, it is a novel, so I did have to just imagine myself into her. And so I did that, and she came to life for me, you know.
So this might be a good time to have you read from the beginning of the novel, if there's anything you want to say about that before you read it.
Well, sure. The novel, it's in three main sections, and then there's a very short prologue and a very short epilogue. And I'll just read the prologue, which hopefully stands on its own since it's the very first thing in the book. The woman had 8 children, the first called Tom in 1603, the final year of Queen Elizabeth's reign. It was 5 daughters and 3 sons, and she dressed them richly but simply and cleanly to ward off sharkly habits. Margaret was the youngest. She made the world her book, took a piece of coal and marked a blank white wall. Later, she made 16 smaller books, untitled, sewn with yarn. Her girlhood heroes were Shakespeare, Ovid, Caesar. She wrote them in beside thinking rocks and humming shoes and her favorite sister, Catherine, who starred in all but 5. Snow fell fast as she sat by the nursery fire, ink to paper, then she sewed. The last book told a tale of hasty gloom, teeming with many shades of green, emerald, viridian, a mossy black. In it we meet a miniature princess who lives in a seashell castle and sleeps in sheets woven from the eyelids of doves. For all these fertile inner workings, Margaret was thought plain. Couldn't wear yellow, was shy, yes, seemed younger than her years, yet Margaret longed for fame. When grown, she would adorn herself like a peacock. Or so wrote the diarist Samuel Pepys, whose curiosity brought him out one day to stand along a London road and wait for her carriage to pass. It was May Day, and the park was like a circus. The Duchess of Newcastle is all the pageant now discoursed on, or so he'd written in his diary several weeks before, at breakfast tables and dinner parties, over porridge or pike or a gravy made from the brains of a pig, she was all that anyone talked about, as watched for as Queen Catherine herself, but a far more thrilling spectacle, those black stars on her cheeks, the scandal at the theater, her hats. One anonymous satirist had dubbed her Welbeck Abbey's illustrious whore. Others called her simply fantastical. An overgrown, spoilt girl. Her work, chaos. Her books, sad heaps of rubbish. Voluminous, some called her. Crack-brained, so extremely picturesque. Yet there were others Pepys knew who considered her the unequaled daughter of the muses, and her latest book a blazing utopia to rival Bacon's own. He tapped his hat for shade. A crow pecked near his feet. He was about to give it up, and then, "Mad Madge," someone cried in the street. "Mad Madge," someone repeated, as her black and silver carriage came roaring down the path. But the horses were forced to a stop, for the crowd had grown a mob. "I see her," someone shouted. He saw her then, through the window glass. Black stars, white cheeks. That night in his diary, he wrote, "The whole story of this lady is a romance, and everything she does."
That's Danielle Dutton reading from her novel, Margaret the First, here on KBOO, Between the Covers. This is Kathleen Stevenson. That passage does talk about some things that happened during the book, gives us a preview mm-hmm. some of the things that happened with Margaret. Talk a little bit about the culture of the time and how she, as a woman, mm-hmm. operates in it, fits in it, mm-hmm. or doesn't fit in.
Right. Well, I mean, it was a fascinating period, right? I mean, what we would call science was just sort of at its dawn, in the sense that of what we would understand it to be, like that it was the dawn of the Enlightenment, and it was the birth of all of these scientific communities. And her husband, who was a very wealthy aristocrat, happened to be a patron and friend to people like Descartes and Hobbes and Johnson. And so once she married, she was in these salons basically overhearing arguments between Descartes and Hobbes, and all of this lit a real fire in her mind. But even before she was married and this happened to her, she was a very bright little girl. She did write these baby books. They aren't in existence, but it's known that she did. She wrote about doing that. She loved to read. She did love Ovid and Shakespeare and Caesar. I mean, she had quite sort of serious tastes for a young woman. From what I've read about her, she seemed like a strangely performative child, but only within the confines of her home and on the estate she grew up on. And then when she went out into the world, like I said, she was just terribly, terribly awkward and uncomfortable. But there was really no place for a woman in the society, in the culture of her day. I mean, in some ways, it's just sort of a magical that she was able to become who she was. I mean, that she was already this very smart, curious, ambitious woman at the time is already, you know, unusual. But then the fact that she married this man who happened not only to be in a position to help her, but then helped her is so amazing. He encouraged her writing. When she started publishing, he sent her books to all of his friends, his illustrious friends. From the moment she joined the Queen's court as a maid during the English Civil War, everyone made fun of her because she was so awkward. And then once she started writing, it just got much worse. You know, people called her a whore or a hermaphrodite or a bearded lady. People were shocked and offended by what she was doing. But her husband supported her all the way through it. And so she got pretty lucky in him. And I mean, we're lucky because then she was able to write all those books. And yeah, they weren't lost, you know, because she published them. So
right. How did you go about writing about their relationship? Did you base it as much as you could on what you had read about that? Or did mm-hmm. you imagine that more?
Both. I mean, when I set out to write the novel, I had no idea how much about the marriage it was going to be. And that was something that came over time. And just in realizing how important William Cavendish was to, you know, the person we know as Margaret Cavendish. And I don't say that in any way to diminish what Margaret herself did, but just that it would have been pretty much impossible without a supportive husband for any woman to do something like that at the time. As far as the marriage itself, I mean, there are biographies of Margaret Cavendish, and I list a few in the back that I found especially enlightening and entertaining. And so if people are interested in her, there are straight biographies to be read. And then, in fact, Virginia Woolf has an essay called The Duchess of Newcastle in her book, The Common Reader. And she talks in a very sort of, again, loving and condescending way about Margaret and William, about this sort of ridiculous scribbling couple, because he wrote plays and poems also, and she imagined them alone in their, you know, their castle in Sherwood Forest, scribbling only to each other, you know. Again, since it's a novel and not a biography, I really did have to imagine their relationship. And I actually think quite a lot about Virginia Woolf and Leonard Woolf. Like I said, Virginia Woolf was the major figure I studied when I was doing my PhD, and their marriage was quite fascinating and complicated. And then I also am a married human, and my husband is incredibly supportive of me as well. And so it's funny, you know, like off the top of my head, I could list 20 horrible marriages in literature. it seems obvious why horrible marriages make for good books, you know, but it's a lot harder to think up good marriages at the centers of books, because, you know, that sounds so boring, but it just was so important. And so it was sort of interesting to try to figure out, like, how do you dramatize a good marriage? Because even good marriages are not good every day. Just trying to sketch, you know, how a marriage grows and evolves over time, I think there's a lot of dynamism in that. By the end, I mean, I realized in some ways this is a book about a marriage, but that was never what I thought I was doing at the beginning. But that always, of course, you know, this book took me 10 years to write. So over 10 years, wow. You know, things change.
It was interesting as the reader to read his reactions to various things that she did and kind of be jolted out of the what you would expect someone of that time, how you would expect a husband to react. And there's one time where he has been away, I think, or isolated in some way, and he says, I wrote a play, and it kind of falls to the wayside because her own actions become the focus just soon after his own expression of his creativity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, when she started writing, people kept accusing him of having written these books. And I mean, at the very beginning, people thought it was some kind of sick joke that he was saying, oh, my wife wrote this book of sort of philosophical poetry. People were like, a woman could never write that. And it's not even that good. So I don't know what he's up to. They were accused of playing this joke where he was writing the books and saying they were hers at the beginning. And then by the end of, you know, her career, near the end of her life, people were saying that she wrote his poems or she wrote his plays. So that was a very strange reversal. I mean, that would be strange now, much less in the 17th century. I mean, that moment that you're talking about, I think, is quite an important moment in their marriage when the power dynamic seems to shift a little bit because she has gotten so famous or notorious during their lifetimes at that point.
The style of the book is very engaging, and it's different. I don't want to put too much of my own characterization on it. Some writing about it call it dreamlike. How did you come up with the style for it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, part of it was the language of the 17th century is really wonderful and dynamic. Language was still... It was less systematic. It was used in a less systematic way than we use language today. I mean, like spelling was much more up for grabs, you know? And I mean, the whole period was sort of felt kind of anti-systematic or hybrid to me. Like a man could be a botanist and an ambassador and a lens maker. And people were doing so many different things and language seemed to move in so many different ways. So I read a lot of 17th century texts. When I first started, I was, like I said, I was still doing my PhD, and I had access to something called Early English Books Online. And it's just this database of scanned texts from the period. As I was reading about the year 1666, for example, I was reading a lot of, like, hilarious astrological rants about the year, the year of the number of the beast, because, you know, 666, and just, like, about comets and, you know, fiery deaths. And so I think that sort of affected my approach going into it, was the language of the period. I read Samuel Pepys's diaries for the years around 1666, and he is hilarious, and his diaries are quite readable and weird. He's quite saucy. So I read a lot of that stuff, and I think that affected it. And then again, to go back to Virginia Woolf, she's basically been here since the beginning. I really think that Woolf's writing sort of, I kept returning to it, reading in particular Woolf's book The Years, which is not one of the more talked about or read of Woolf's books, but a really beautiful book that I love and a novel. So I just kept returning to Woolf's language and looking at how Woolf even just talks about a tree and how beautiful that passage will be. And I think that for me, it was important that the book feel like it was steeped in beauty and wonder, because to me, my experience of that, of the period, was so full of beauty and wonder. And of course, there's all kinds of horrible things too, but I wanted the book to feel like that. I mean, there's also violence in the book, and, you know, there's a war going on in the background the whole time. And there's obviously misogyny, and there's, you know, all kinds of things happening at the time. But I wanted beauty, and I wanted wonder, and I wanted the feeling of those 17th century texts. And in fact, the first part I ever wrote is the first part of the third section where Margaret is thinking about how she's just finished her masterpiece, a description of a new world called The Blazing World. And she's nervous about what people will think about it, just like any writer would be today. She's thinking about all the things she's been reading. And there's all these quotes like flying through her mind about the men and the sort of the science, the natural philosophy she's been reading. And that was the first thing I wrote. And it was just a very lyrical, sort of meta-textual thing. And so I think that was like the spring for the rest of the book.
You bring up this book, The Blazing World. Tell us about that.
Well, it's great. I mean, it's a wonderful document. Sort of people have called it a proto-novel or proto-science fiction. There wasn't fiction the way we think of it at this point. It's a sort of a genre all its own. It's a utopia, and it's a response to Francis Bacon's New Atlantis, which has at its center the Solomon's House of Learned Men, and the learned men sit around and are learned with each other. And there is a passage in the book where I think women are allowed to come listen, but they have to sit up in a gallery behind stained glass. That's all I really remember of that. But I mean, you can imagine what Margaret thought of that idea. So she wrote this response where there's two worlds joined at their poles, and a lady from ostensibly our world accidentally crosses into the blazing world when the ship she's on loses its course and just passes into the other world. And over there, there's talking bears and talking spiders and talking fishmen and talking birdmen. But there apparently are no women. There are no other women referenced in the book. And so when this lady passes in, the bear men and all these other guys take her to their emperor, who makes her his wife. And she promptly becomes the patron of art and science in the blazing world. And so Margaret's utopia is about this woman who's in charge, basically, of art and science. And she tells all the men what to do. And she tells them, for example, that she doesn't like microscopes, which Margaret didn't. She called it a brittle art. And she thought it just limited our understanding of nature and didn't enhance it. So she writes this strange, you know, feminist utopia or proto-feminist utopia, where a woman gets to speak her mind and everyone has to listen. And actually, they have to do what she says. I mean, some of her ideas seem ridiculous or fanciful to us, but almost all of the men of the day, too, who are famous now for their writing or their experiments, also had plenty of totally fanciful and ridiculous seeming ideas. But if you keep her in context, I think she's a pretty interesting and reasonable figure from the period, on top of which she had no formal education and they all did. So she was sort of doing the best she could with just gleaning things from listening in to the men talking. Yeah, I think she did an amazing job.
Again, I'm speaking with Danielle Dutton. We're talking about her book, her novel, Margaret the First, based on this very interesting life of Margaret Cavendish. How did you see her changing, her character changing as she got older? Because you can feel it when you read the book.
I mean, I think one of the things that the book is about is what we do when something we're working towards, we actually accomplish it. So what happens when you think, if only I could just get this, and then you sort of get it, and you're still just you? I guess it's a sort of a middle-aged experience in some ways. But what happens when you actually succeed, and yet it doesn't really solve who you are? It doesn't take away whatever that pain that you feel is. And so I think there's just a growing up, like a sort of in, she just gets richer, but she always stays, I don't mean this in a condescending way at all, but there's something childlike about her. And maybe that childlike is the wrong word. Other people have been telling me they think of her that way. But I think it's wonder. I mean, she remains totally alive to wonder throughout her life. And I love that constant about her. Maybe she gets sadder as the book goes on.
There is a little bit of melancholy underlying things.
Right. But I don't think it's like a terribly sad book or something. But I think that's in her. Yeah.
She never had children.
Right.
And was there much made of that in the literature about her?
I make much of it in the novel because it seemed important to me that there was this woman who couldn't have children for whatever reason. I mean, they tried. It was either her or her husband. They were clearly infertile. She couldn't have children. And it seemed important to me as a woman now to think about how that left room for something else in her life. And especially because toward the end of her life, she writes about her works as paper bodies. And this was actually one of the first things I read about her in this wonderful collection of her works, edited collection called Paper Bodies. So I was so attracted to that idea that the infertility seemed really important to me. But it is also written about in her biographies, and a lot of the medical treatments that I mentioned that she underwent came from her biographies. Not all of them, but some of them I read about elsewhere and just thought, ooh, let's use that one too, because they're so peculiar. I mean, there was like the excrement of a virile lamb rubbed on her belly, and there was injections of herbs into her womb.
Some kind of metal concoction.
Yeah, right. The steel shavings, that she drank. Yeah, I mean, that definitely happened to her. So I think another person could have written the book and downplayed that, and I chose to make sure that it was a sort of presence throughout the book. It was important to me. When I started the book, I did not have a child and wasn't sure if I ever would. And then when I finished the book, I did. And so I think that that was also on my mind as I was writing. But also what I read about her death, from what I understand, no one knows exactly why she died at 49. But it seems possible to me when I was reading things that she had undergone all these hideous treatments. I mean, that seemed like it would have taken a toll over time. And also she herself was prone to like doing a bleeding or vomits or leeches and things like that. It seemed to me possible that she'd weakened her system with all of this over many, many years. And also, I just love the medical treatments. They're crazy. Like, they're absurd to the point of becoming like poetry. You know, they just go so far one way that they come back the other or something. Yeah.
Do you think she was a feminist?
No, because I hesitate to apply any totally contemporary words to back onto her. She just would not have ever conceived of feminism the way we do. Having said that, I mean, she obviously wrote about how she thought women shouldn't be kept, you know, in their homes or in their husbands' beds or always having children. And why there was no reason that they shouldn't be educated. Many things that we would think of as being sort of proto-feminist are absolutely present in her thoughts and in her writing. And she could also be very hard on women. You know, she thought that women gossiped too much and were too silly and idle, some of which she blamed on men and on society, and some of which she seemed to blame on women. And that was not at all uncommon. Wolfe was quite hard on Cavendish, you know, and so like the patriarchy lives through all of us. I don't feel comfortable calling her a feminist, but I think you can see where she stands in the sort of in a growing movement. I think she's an important figure. She's not unknown, but I had never heard of her, and I was doing a PhD in English, and so it seems like she could be better known.
Well, we're almost out of time, and one thing I would ask is if this kind of writing, this maybe using a historical figure, one person called your novel an anti-historical historical novel, which is kind of fun.
Yeah.
But is that, do you think that's going to be part of what you do in the future, or will it influence what you do in the future somehow?
Well, I'm not sure, but my trajectory so far has been that after I finish one book, my impulse is to do something completely different. When I talk about writing with my students, I often talk about the painter Gerhard Richter and how from one period to the next, it's like it's almost unbelievable that it's the same person. And I'm really fascinated by artists who work in that way. And I can see similarities in my three books, but stylistically, they're quite different. And I think my impulse is to just like, okay, I got that out of my system. Now, what is the next thing I need to get out? But what needs to happen is that I need to become fascinated by something again. And with my previous book, Sprawl, I became fascinated by this question of, I was studying modernist poems, and someone said they were the poetics of the city. And not coming from a city myself, I just started wondering what the poetics of the suburbs might sound like. And this was suddenly a problem that fascinated me. Then Margaret Cavendish became a problem that fascinated me. And so I'm just waiting for the next problem. But I don't know what it will be or what it will sound like when I find it. Mm-hmm, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank you very much for coming in, Danielle
Dutton.
Thank you so much for coming into KBOO and talking about your book. And again, I want to let people know that I've been speaking with Danielle Dutton. The title of her novel is Margaret the First. This is Between the Covers. I'm Kathleen Stevenson. If you missed part of this interview or want to hear it again, it will be available on our website, kboo.fm/between the covers, later today.
KBOO at the Clinton is our monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, Pinkwashing Exposed, will play Thursday, June 9th at 7 p.m. Pinkwashing is a term used when entities engaged in terrible human rights violations promote themselves as gay-friendly to improve their public image. Israel is the country most famous for this strategy. Pinkwashing Exposed explores how pinkwashing works and what activists are doing to fight back, including activists from Seattle who succeeded in 2012 in canceling high-profile queer events, and more. Again, that's Pinkwashing Exposed. Thursday, January 9th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Don't worry, I won't hurt you. I only want you to have some fun.
Dearly beloved, KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Prince vs. Bowie Memorial Bike Ride on Saturday, June 11th. Put on some purple, grab your dancing shoes, and a bicycle for a rock and mobile dance party with Diablo. We'll gather at 7 p.m. at Sewell Crest Park on Southeast 32nd Avenue, just south of Hawthorne. More information at kboo.fm under Community Events. Again, Prince vs. Bowie, Saturday, June 11th at 7 p.m.
I admit that in the past I've been a nasty. They weren't kidding when they called me, well, a witch. But you'll find that nowadays I've mended all my ways, repented, seen the light, and made a switch. True, yes.
Hello and welcome to Words and Pictures, the comics and animation show. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And today I'm joined by one of the great American animators working today. She's brought characters to life in such films as The Little Mermaid, The Black Cauldron, How to Train Your Dragon, and Frozen. And she's been called the queen of animated villains. Kathy Zielinski, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So at Disney, you animated Ursula the Sea Witch in The Little Mermaid and Jafar in Aladdin, and you were